The following Dharma encounter with Ron Hogan Green Sensei took place at Zen Mountain Monastery at the conclusion to a week-long meditation session. As you'll hear, Dharma encounters begin with the introduction of a topic related to Zen practice and training. Students then volunteer to present their understanding of the topic or a question for the Dharma encounter teacher to reflect on. The presence of fellow students means that anyone in attendance can benefit from the exchange. We hope you enjoy.
Well, good morning and welcome to everybody near and far. How's our sound? This morning, in place of the usual Sunday program, we'll be doing Dharma Encounter. And for those of you who are not familiar with that, the Dharma Encounter is held, at the end of each session, one a month during the 3-month Ango training period. The Ango training period is a tradition that goes back to the time of the Buddha. And within that tradition, that was a time that the Sangha would gather and receive the teachings from the teachers and seniors, ask questions, investigate. And so we'll be doing that today. That form, in one way or another, has come down through many schools of Buddhism, but particularly in Zen, it has a very particular flavor. The Dharma encounter is one form of teaching between a teacher and students. It's very similar to Daisan or Doksan, which, as most of us know, is an intimate face-to-face teaching that takes place in a small room and is intensely private and not spoken of in general. This is similar to that, but it's public. And in being public, it offers a teaching of students coming forth, of sharing their questions, their understanding, the places that they wish to explore. And we all get to benefit from that. The exchanges can be very directly pointing, or they can be more conceptual. It depends on the student, on what they bring forth, on the appropriateness of how the teaching can be presented. But the intent is always to help the student go deeper, become clearer in the Dharma, and help them realize themselves. That's always the intent. This encounter today is also preparation, a rehearsal, if you will, for next month when Chike, our chief disciple, who has been leading the Sangha, stepping forward into a position of responsibility and seniority, acting as a model of practice and having some instruction responsibility, offering encouragement during the session, during sittings. And she'll lead this Dharma encounter next month. Good luck. So this is a lot of things. I'll mention in a few moments, and we'll explore a bit what the topic is. And one of the interesting things about this, and tensions and excitements, is that nobody here knows the topic, except hopefully me. And I don't know what you're going to come up and say. I will suggest some directions, but you don't have to follow them. And so you can bring forth a question, a challenge, an understanding, whatever you need to bring forward. I would encourage you to come forward. It doesn't happen unless you do. The topic for today that we'll explore together is vow. And, you know, I'm looking at the Zendo, and there's a lot of people wearing roxus, a lot of people in black robes, as well as new people. And one of the things that makes this alive, aside from its unrehearsed nature, is that different people with different levels of experience come forth and share their practice and explore with me. And that gives it life. So the Merriam-Webster definition of vow is a solemn promise or assertion specifically, one by which a person is bound to an act, service, or condition. Also to bind or concentrate by a vow. An oath, a pledge, a promise. And we're familiar with vows, certainly in the secular world. Politicians take them. In marriage, they're usually an exchange of vows. And I think we're also familiar with, in the secular world, how vows are treasured or not treasured, how they're honored or not honored. And we see that. Does this describe the vows of Zen practice? Master Dogen made this vow. From this life throughout countless lives, we vow with all beings to hear the true Dharma. Hearing it, no doubt arises, nor is faith lacking. Meeting and maintaining it, we renounce worldly affairs. And together with all beings and the great earth, realize the Buddha way. I think we can feel this. And it doesn't feel to me like the vows that are usually taken in static in a regular society. It's a different depth, seriousness, feel, commitment. And this is not a static pledge, but a dynamic response to the circumstances and expressions of how we can address our suffering, your suffering, my suffering, arising out of our true nature. So it's fundamental. It's the fundamental basis of our practice. And it feels to me, this particular vow and the ones we take, like a demand that I make to myself to uphold, to practice, to realize, and within that to do the best I can, knowing that I may not always do so well, and yet continue to investigate and manifest it to the best of my ability, trusting it, having faith in it. Zen practice is the practice of Mahayana, the vow of the Bodhisattva, the Mahayana ideal is to put forth others' enlightenment and others' well-being before one's own. It's interesting to me, fascinating, that socially at this time, there's enormous attention to self-care, to, in some subtle or overt way, self-concern and greed is good. It seems manifested. I mean, the overt examples of that are obvious, certainly politically, but the more subtle implications of that are present as well. And so this is a very different perspective than the necessary self-care that we all have to take care with ourself, with our particular karma, with the specifics of our life that if we don't take care of, that really we are defeated by life, in a sense. So that is whole and true. And it's not excluded by these vows that I'm talking about. And yet something more is present with these vows, much more. So our vows state our intent. We hold the practice of our vows and support the realization of our Buddha nature, not just for our sake, but for the sake of all beings. It's a given from the Mahayana perspective that anyone can raise the desire for enlightenment, what we call bodhicitta, and that anyone can practice and realize themselves. Now, I just want to be careful here, because enlightenment, realization, can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. In the course of practice, though, we understand that we're on a path, and we take up this path, and that in and of itself is both the road and the realization. The road to realization and the realization. And practice works in many different ways for each individual, according to the karma, the dedication to it. So let's not get stuck on some idea of enlightenment, but the practice of enlightenment. That's what is within our power, to practice that. And to have faith and trust in a way that we may not know that we will realize ourselves. And this is what we're doing here in practicing the Bodhisattva path. It's not casual. It's a commitment. To put this another way, we vow in this practice to become Buddhas, small b, and to help others become Buddhas. Our vows are interwoven throughout our practice, sometimes obvious and out there and bold. Sometimes it challenges us to see how the vow is entwined in our practice. I started to write a list of the ways that practice to me brings forth the vows. Obviously, the Bodhisattva vows, the verse of the Kesa, taking the precepts, Jhikkhai, taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the meal chants, the Heart Sutra, the identity of relative and absolute, and on and on and on. In fact, I realized I should have made a list of the things that don't involve vow. There'd be nothing on it. So how do these vows influence us? Influence us as we recite and practice them, or don't practice them. Often our intent is clear, but what happens when the energy that comes out of that dies down? When ordinary life is before us, when we're not held in this container, where all of us chant together, and the walls shake, and we shake with the intensity of our vow. during Jikai, the taking of the precepts, the preceptor asks at the end, after they're taken, to the people taking them, will you maintain them? And again, the preceptor asks, will you maintain them? And again, the preceptor asks, will you really maintain them? What does it mean to maintain a vow? That's a very personal question. That's not a, I'll look it up in Google and see what it says to maintain a vow. That's our path. So specifically in this encounter, I'd like to take up a practice of the four bodhisattva vows. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Desires are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. The dharmas are boundless. I vow to master them. The Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to attain it. So, as I mentioned, I'm going to put some questions out there. Use them or don't use them. I want you to take them in, so hopefully it'll spark what's relevant for you. How do we understand each vow? Just one of them or all of them? I mean, deeply understand it, personally. How do we profess and maintain faith in these vows? I mean, is faith necessary? What's the relationship of faith to these vows? How do we live our life out of these vows in this world of complexity and confusion? That's such a countercurrent to these vows. More than a countercurrent, a wave that seems to overwhelm us with the intensity and depth of greed, anger, and delusion. Within each vow, the impossibility of fulfilling the vow is brought forth. Can't be done. How do we understand that? How does that influence our understanding and our practice of them? How do you understand that our practice is based on our vows? And that our zazen is based on our vows. What do these vows have to do with the most fundamental teaching of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths? Do they have anything to do with that? And finally, the Buddha gets the last word here. Subhuti, he says, what do you think? What do you think? And he goes on. You should not claim that the Tathagata has the thought, I will liberate sentient beings. Subhuti, do not have any such thought. Why? There are in fact no sentient beings for the Tathagata to liberate. If there were sentient beings liberated by the Tathagata, it would mean that the Tathagata holds the view, the notions of a self, a person, a sentient being, or a lifespan. Subhuti, when the Tathagata says I, there's actually no I. Yet ordinary beings think there is a real I. Subhuti, the Tathagata says that ordinary beings are in fact not ordinary beings. Therefore, they're called ordinary beings. So that's a plateful. In the call to come up, I would hope that we have a good mix of folks, Jikai, monastics, people who are new to this practice, people who've practiced a while, so that we can come forth, they can come forth, and we can receive the different perspectives of practice, the depth of practice, the questions that come up at various times in practice, and take that in. You know, one of my pet peeves that I sometimes use, probably slightly inappropriately, is that this can be entertainment Zen, right? It's fascinating. But that's not what's going on here. I hope for you it's not what's going on for you. It is entertaining, if not fascinating. But it's real. You make it real, and I make it real. So GK will start, and she'll make three bows and end with three bows. And everyone else who comes up will do one bow coming in and one bow ending. And so let's begin, please. Get online. I hope she's not alone. And we'll go from there.
So, Tanji, in your talks, you often bring up the point about how this is deeply personal for each of us. I have tried to maintain these vows since I took them in 2005, formally. And sometimes I feel overwhelmed by the impossibility of those vows, especially in the world that you referenced in your opening remarks. In your talk earlier this week, you used a term that stayed with me, the samsaric chessboard, that I spend a lot of my time trying to negotiate and not negotiate. The way that I try and manifest these vows in my life, in my practice, in thinking about all sentient beings, is in the greatest sense, all sentient beings, vast, but I'm part of them too. My desires show themselves to me all the time, all the time. And part of the way I try and practice them is to recognize when they are coming up and not follow that story and let it go and notice that it's going to be a condition of my ongoing life that I have desires that I want to chase. I practice my understanding of the dharmas of boundless is I really have found more and more, much more to come, I think, that I find teachings everywhere, everywhere in the puppy, in washing the dishes, in consternation by my students at work, in my frustrations about how we are harming ourselves in this society. I feel compelled to do something about Eurocentrism and patriarchy in this world. Something about that. So my vows give me a way to manage my upset and sometimes anger and frustration with that. I can turn to the precepts and think, okay, how can I actualize goodness? I can't, and although I'm a control freak, I can't control anybody but me, just me. So the question I ask myself often is, okay, how can I show up in this moment the best way I know how? And I have these lists of things, all these vows, okay, which one comes into play here? You know, like, okay, don't speak of others' errors and faults. Okay, don't cloud your mind. I always feel like I'm not doing enough. I always feel like I'm saying too much.
Yeah.
Is there a way that our practice offers us to be more and more skillful in engaging all of this catastrophe?
There's a couple of things I'd like to say, if I may. It's going to sound funny, but the skillful part is easy, because there's a flashing red light when you're not skillful. We suffer. And the more we do this practice, the more sensitive we are to the suffering we create. It's intolerable. So, there's that. Speaking just for myself, I look for the way in. And I've got two main doors that I keep coming back to. One is the three pure precepts. And I hold up my actions to not creating evil. Not creating evil. I know what evil is. You know what evil is. Now, I only have direct influence and control on what I create. That's enough. That's where I start. And it's enough. The other is to recognize my faults, my transgressions, a long list, and see how I can turn each one, what I call turn each one, to good for others. That's very personal and very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. I made a mistake during this session. I don't have to say what it is, but I hurt people. And yes, you can apologize, but more is required. Much more. And some of it is not obvious to us. It's deeply ingrained. It's that tale that Shugen Roshi spoke about. And when I get there, I get desperate. I feel I have to fight for my life in the best possible way. Meaning something has to be given up. And I don't want to give up. But I have to. Because my vow is bigger than what I think I want. Which I didn't even realize, because it just comes out of habit and conditioning and it's automatic. So for me, I really start there. More can come along, but I keep it very, very simple on what I relate to. And in doing that, it leads everywhere. May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanshi, you read a vow towards the beginning about renouncing worldly affairs, and I have a couple of questions about that. You're wearing a white robe. Can you tell me how you renounce worldly affairs?
Yeah. I never take off my robe. Now, obviously, I remove it, but I never take off my robe.
How is that renunciation?
In the midst of the craziness of the world, I'm full in.
Full in?
To renunciation.
Full in?
Full in. All in.
All in.
And what does that mean? How is that skillful? How is that not skillful? That's my koan. Your koan.
But what are you renouncing?
I'm renouncing my tendency to create evil, to create self-centeredness, to create to carefully inspect what I want and to say, what does the other person need? Not from some imaginative or Disney World idea of what the other person needs, but what does the other person need to help them realize themselves? Now, the person I'm dealing with out there isn't Buddhist, isn't thinking in terms of realizing themselves. So the way I understand realizing themselves is, how can they become fully human? How can their suffering decrease? Now, it's often very subtle. More times than not, there's nothing to say. But perhaps something can be communicated through eye contact, through the ineffable. But sometimes it can be offered in a way that is not me offering to you. And so how I say it, how I allow my love and respect for the other person, I'm using love in a particular way, how I honor that other person within their suffering, which they don't perceive as suffering, perhaps. So in a way, this is not grandiose. It's sometimes, I was once on the subway, and I was sitting in a seat on the subway, and I saw a woman who had a lot of packages. The subway was crowded, and I looked at her, and I looked at my seat. And she said, that was enough. So, we have to be attentive. We have to take up our vow as the center of our life, in a sense, without obsession, understanding that we're often clumsy, that this is not a, we happily live after and I do something good and the world responds. It's just, we pay attention. We see. We look how we can help, which is sometimes a step forward and often a step back out of respect. And also means sometimes that respect means to let the person have their karma, even though you may recognize this is not going to end well. And that has to do with permission, right? As students, and I'm a student, we know that the student has to give permission to receive the teachings from the teacher. And that takes place on that subway car. What do I know? I don't know anything. Or as it's saying in Brooklyn, I don't know shit.
Thank you for your teaching.
May your life go well.
So, Sanji, I want to share how I find my vows nested, like Russian nesting dolls. When I was married, I am married, when we were married, one of my wife's vows to me was to help me towards a more spiritual path. She, having been a casual Zen practitioner and me a casual Buddhist. Little did I know that in my marriage it would become very difficult. Our 5 years have been challenging, and instead of a sort of hand-in-hand through that vow, I took refuge in my Buddhist and Zen vows. They helped me stay. The seeing the desires as inexhaustible, watching each and every one of them, became my practice to see the desire for a easier marriage or a different wife or just a getaway, a different place. So knowing you, that you've been married for much longer than I have and are much wiser than I am in this practice, I ask, What have your vows shown you about staying in marriage vows?
When I was young and stupid, which isn't to say I'm not old and stupid now, but when I was young and stupid, I was, in a sense, had control of my world. I was a doctor. It was the 70s and 80s. There was a running boom going on in Colorado. Colorado was full of attractive people, female, male. I would often come into my office to treat athletes and runners and be dressed, just gone running during lunch hour, dressed casually in my running stuff. And there's someone very attractive in front of me who would make overt and sometimes anatomically descriptive offers. And it was attractive. There was a part of me that wanted that. And I knew then, in that particular time and place, I could have that. I could have a lot of that. Or I could have one loving relationship that I was completely invested in, that I had vowed to be invested in. Couldn't have them both. Can't have them both. Now, other people may feel differently, but that was me. And I knew what I wanted. And so, I was all in on my marriage. Having said that, we recognize that things change, people change, circumstances change, what we want, what they want, and relationship changes. But I made a vow. So I was going to take that as far as I could. And my vow included that if my partner decided to leave me, I was going to open the door for her, because I loved her so much, so she could leave. That was part of my vow. I also understood, talked about maintaining vows. That's an enormous challenge, because desires are inexhaustible. One other point, which is of interest to me, which I've studied, and that often we choose a partner that we feel complements us, that offers us what we feel we need, that we lack. And that inherently presents friction, attention, because they're not me. They're not doing things the way I would do them. They're doing things the way they do them. That's not right. They should do it the way I want them to do it, tell them to do it, subtly or overtly, or communicate it without words. So to respect, what does love mean in that relationship? It means the deepest kind of respect for that partner. Now, again, please don't misunderstand. I'm not judging myself or others if the appropriate thing is for that marriage, for that vows not to be upheld. It would be good if you do that together and you both feel that that is the best way to uphold the vow. That if we're going to create suffering and harm this way, and we've tried what can be tried, and it doesn't work, then it doesn't make sense to hold to a vow that is destructive. We've all seen, perhaps different generations, but perhaps not, you know, the marriage that goes on for 50 years and really, really is terrible. We've all seen the marriage that one partner often but not exclusively male, dominates. Maybe they're a genius, or maybe they're very smart, and the attention and the other partner is diminished by that. Does the first partner have any awareness of that? How are they taking care of their partner? So there's endless aspects of this. But what runs through that is the vow and the love and the commitment to my partner. And so my practice is, as best I can, not always successful. Successful meaning in my mind. When my partner is hurting or not doing well or unhappy, what do you need? I ask, what do you need? Shugan Roshi taught me that. What do you need? May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching. Shosanji, thanks for your wisdom so far. If we can continue this.
I'll try.
In terms of the four vows, I have two versions that I recite, usually daily. In the evening, I do the traditional four vows that we chant here every day. The morning one is different because I need encouragement in a sort of practical way. So I have a version of Thich Nhat Hanh's that I use. It goes something like this, if I can remember it all in this pressured situation. However numerous sentient beings may be, I vow to meet them with kindness and interest. However inexhaustible the states of suffering, I vow to touch them with love and patience. However boundless the dharmas, I vow to see, be free mindfully. And last one, however incomprehensible the states of the...
Okay.
No, however incomprehensible the mystery of interbeing, I vow to surrender to it freely. So that's meaningful in a different way to me, like to start the day and to consider firstly, you know, others and being there with them.
Well, thank you for sharing that. That's the point of really our practice, is to find our way in as an individual, someone practicing the Dharma, as a would-be Nirvanakaya, Nirvanakaya Buddha, meaning this person doing their best to wake up, this person with your karma and your glasses and eyes and age and wisdom. And you're doing what you need to do within the context of the precepts. And that's the path. That's it. And the advantage you have is you've been practicing so long that you trust that. In the beginning, it's much harder. We're so... Perhaps one way to say is not so necessarily connected with the Dharma or with our understanding. Or trusting that, the later we do. And in that path, we find what we need so that we can help others find what they need to become fully human. May your life go well.
Thank you. So, Shanji, this week, when I was blown around on the cushion,
There was a couple of things that helped me sit strong. One of them is that popped into my head, thankfully, was a description of Zazen that I read once from a Japanese master who said, Zazen is a process of vow and repentance. I vow to be present with what is, and when I'm not, to repent and go back. And I couldn't do that all the time. And so the other vow that kept me sitting was the three treasures. Taking refuge. With the Sangha.
You know, I talked about how vows are in everything we do. I could have easily used taking refuge. In that sense, they're no different. So, you should understand that when you take refuge, everything, imagined and unimagined, is taking refuge with you. And that's why it helps you. May your life go well.
Hogan Sensei. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Yesterday morning, I was walking down that mountain in the dark by the light of the moon, and a sadness began to grow inside me. And in that first period of Zazen, I went to a very dark place. I thought about a person in my life that has caused me great harm and caused himself great harm and my closest loved ones inconceivable harm so far. And I sat with that for the first two periods of Zazen as tears just poured down my face, snot, my mouth. And then, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. I gave up that vow. I can't do that. I can't even save this one sentient being. I can't save this person.
When you say this one, which one are you talking about?
Sorry. The person I was thinking of. I can't save this person. And that was painful to feel that relinquishing of that vow, to accept it. It was thrust upon me. But there was something else too in the pain, something different. And that evening, after the last Zazen, I was walking up that mountain in the dark, by the light of the moon. And I thought to myself, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Sentient beings are numberless. Numberless does not mean so many of them that you can't count them. That's not what that word means. Numberless. So my question for you is, sentient beings are numberless. How many of them are there?
May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
Shosanchi. So we've been talking a lot about energy and power and anger. And I feel like I want to kind of hone these things into a sword that I can use skillfully, which I'm learning. At the same time, I actually feel so powerless so much of the time. And I feel, I know we talked about the tail through the window. I feel like to give that up, I know it's not about giving it up, but I would feel so, I would feel so powerless. I already, there's so many times I feel so overwhelmed. And I feel like that's what I have.
So are you saying that you feel powerless, so you're going to hold on to your power as much as you can, whatever little there is,
yeah,
to protect you?
It feels like that.
So how's that working for you?
I don't know, sometimes it seems okay. I get a lot of stuff done.
Oh, you got a lot of stuff done.
I got a lot of stuff done, but...
We'll put that on your tombstone. She got a lot of stuff done.
But, you know, as we've talked about, I also unintentionally just sort of, you know, can leave a lot of things sort of in my wake.
Yeah. Are those two things connected?
Probably. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's what we're talking about. Like, yeah. Can I do what I do? Or I know it's not about getting things done, but I feel like...
Yeah, that, you feel like
I
what?
I feel like I can... I feel a lot
You don't quite buy it, huh? While I'm investigating that it's not about getting things done, I'm going to get a lot of things done.
Right.
Yeah. So again, how's that working for you?
Well, I mean...
Why are you up here crying?
Because I feel like something's being asked of me that I don't know if I'm ready to do.
Okay, well that's... I don't know if you're ready to do it either. And my experience in Zen is I'll never feel ready to do what I need to do, what I want to do. I mean, that vow, how could I, me, Hogan, Ronnie Green from Brooklyn, do any of this shit? Yeah. I can't. It has nothing to do with me. I mean, it does in a way, but not from that perspective. So, a couple of things. Giving up your power, consciously, or skillfully, appropriately, is the most powerful thing in the world in terms of alleviating suffering, your suffering. Why is that?
Because then it's never my power anyway.
It's never been your power.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how you use your power.
How do I use my power?
No, in using your power. You know if you use your power in a particular way, this will result. Do you know that? In fact, most of the time it doesn't. And even if it does, so what? So, power is interesting. I'm certainly attracted to it. I mean, that's how I survived my life. But it's in a subtle and profound way, deep way. Don't misunderstand what I'm about to say. It's creating evil.
Mm.
And the question is, why is it creating evil? You're here.
Okay. I thought maybe it was rhetorical.
No. I tend not to ask rhetorical questions.
So why is power evil?
The way you're describing power.
The way I'm describing it is it's still about me. The
exactly.
way I'm describing it is it's still, if I'm wielding that sword, no matter how skillfully I think I'm wielding it, it's still me wielding it.
Yeah.
And I know, I mean, that's the thing, that's the problem.
Yeah.
Like, everywhere.
So, we work on that, right? We're working on that. In Daisan.
We're working on it.
Yeah. So, to take that energy of your pain and your the energy which you're spending in, you know, accomplishing, and to put it directly into your koan. Mm. Directly. Mm. We'll show you exactly, to a certain extent, what the Buddha meant in that last quote. It's when he says that there are no sentient beings to save. He wasn't talking theoretically. He's talking about you. So you're trying to save yourself. But if you don't see at some point, and you're in the process of seeing that there's no one to save, suffering results. And if you do see it, there it is, saved. Do you understand?
I think so.
Yeah. May your life go well.
I'm unclear when they say you should take up your vows, or you should practice hard, or these kind of things. I'm not entirely clear yet on who that guy is, because it seems like there's like a number of suspects to me, like, you know, like
the usual suspects.
Yeah,
me, mine, right. Whatever I can grab.
Right. So, when a teacher, or in all aspects of life, when someone tells you to try hard or to take up these vows or something, sometimes I'm not exactly sure who to point to. I was wondering who that guy is.
Feel that?
Yeah.
That guy.
Thank you.
May life go well.
So, Shanchi, I've seen that my practice of vow has all to do with my practice of mindfulness. You have said that vow is about intention. So, I think my vows are the most powerful and beautiful thing in my life, and I intend to live by those vows. And I work to stay as mindful as I can. But I have seen that there are gaps. There are small ones, big ones, and I want to learn how to close those gaps and make them smaller and smaller, and to learn how to be continuous in the practice of my vow. And I know intention is important, and I feel that intention, but there are still gaps, many gaps, and I look for ways to close those gaps.
Why? Why?
Well, yeah. So, intention by itself doesn't seem to be enough.
No. Right. It's a start.
Yeah.
A big start.
Okay.
But when you get down to the nitty-gritty of actually addressing suffering,
yeah,
it doesn't fill that gap.
No, it's not, yeah. So the little tiny gaps, how do you get to them? How do you close them?
So I'm going to ask you a trick question here. Is your intent and your vow, does it fill you up?
Yes.
It does?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
You're sorry? Why are you sorry?
This is a gift that somebody gave me. When the Dharma, the vow, fills your body and mind, then you realize something is missing. What did I just say? And, of course, that's a quote from Dogen via Shugen Rashi.
Yeah. There's more to do.
Now, there is always more to do. Always, always, always. You will never fill those gaps. Ever, ever. You'll fill some. And as soon as you fill those, you'll see more subtly others. Because, unless I'm mistaken, you're a human being. But there's something more there. And you know there's something more, but you don't know what it is. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think that more is?
Just what's right in front of me. The next most appropriate thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not what I'm pointing at. That's true, but it's not what I'm pointing at.
So, tell me.
You're in front of me.
I...
What did I just say? Put it in your words.
We're not separate.
It's more subtle than that. How does your desire to fill the gaps and your insistence on the primacy of fulfilling your vows, how is that tied in with your sense of yourself?
It's my life now.
Oh, that's a big idea, but that's not what I'm pointing to. I understand it's your life, And I deeply, deeply respect that. But I'm suggesting something else.
How is it myself, my sense of self?
So apply these statements to your intent to fulfill your vows and to live out of that. Subhuti, what do you think? You should not claim that the Tathagata has the thought, I will liberate all sentient beings. Subhuti, do not have a thought. Why there are no sentient beings for the Tathagata to liberate? What does that have to do with you?
It's big. I lose my breath. I can't do this. It's too big.
I thought you lived your life around these vows. How could it be too big? Are you not?
I guess it's not too big, but it feels too big.
Oh, well, sure. These vows are impossible. We can't do them. Yeah. But they're doable.
Yeah.
So give me back what I'm pointing at here.
It's more than an intention. It is a practice.
And what's the practice of? Putting the vows aside. Putting the vows aside, what is it a practice of? What did the Buddha say it's a practice of?
The self. Realize the self.
I would put it another way. That's true. I would put it to realize the no self.
Yeah, but it comes around, doesn't it?
But can you see that in yourself?
Not completely, no.
All right. I would most humbly request that you take it up with Shugan Roshi. May your life go well. I don't think I have a way to put a nice summation to this. I think it speaks for itself. I hope it speaks for itself. And that each of us will take it in, appropriate to ourselves and to our practice and to what we want. There's nothing I can add to the teachings and the vows that Dogen has offered us. And just as important, what the Buddha has offered us. Thank you for your practice. Thank you for taking it in. Thank you for, I hope, that you, together with me, will look at this and practice this. Because when the Dharma fills your body and mind, then you realize something is missing. And that's our practice, what we have. And yet something in terms of our realization is missing. And nothing more needs to be said.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.